Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Helles Foundation and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with Larry Tye, whose new book is The Jazz Men: How Duke Ellington, Louis Armstrong, and Count Basie Transformed America. Tye is the New York Times bestselling author of Bobby Kennedy and Satchel, as well as Demagogue, Superman, The Father of Swing, Homelands, and Rising from the Rails. Previously an award-winning reporter at the Boston Globe, he now runs the Health Coverage Fellowship. We're speaking to him today from his home in Cape Cod about his new book, The Jazz Men: How Duke Ellington, Louis Armstrong, and Count Basie Transformed America. Larry Tye, welcome to The Reading Life.
Great to be on with you.
What a fascinating book this is, so brilliantly organized and beautifully written. And two of your previous books led to this one, Rising from the Rails and Satchel. Talk a little bit about that outgrowth for me, would you?
Sure. So it all started with these men called Pullman Porters, the black men who worked on the railroad from the end of the Civil War until the mid-1960s. And during that time, that was the best job a black man could get in America. It let them earn money to put their kids through school. It let them see America, and it let them meet amazing people like Satchel Paige, the Negro League's baseball player who may have been the best pitcher ever, and like Duke Ellington, Louis Armstrong, and Count Basie. And the Pullman Porters made me promise when I got done writing about them that someday I would do a book on Satchel. And I did several years ago. And more importantly, they made me promise that someday I would write about their three favorite all-time passengers, who were three guys named Duke Ellington, Louis Armstrong, and Billy Count Basie. And the reason they were their favorite passengers says to me a lot about the jazz men, a lot about the Pullman Porters, but most importantly, a lot about America. And it was that in that era of Jim Crow racial segregation, where if these black musicians, no matter how popular they were, and they were as popular as you could get, when they traveled below the Mason-Dixon line in that era, if they picked the wrong restaurant to try to get a meal or the wrong hotel to try to book a room, meaning whites-only restaurants or whites-only hotels, they could be berated, or they could actually be beaten up. And so what they did when they went south in that era was they would rent a private Pullman sleeping car. And if they were doing a concert somewhere like New Orleans, they would pull the car off on a sidetrack, and at the end of the night when they were done with their performance, they would go back to their Pullman sleeper, knowing that they had a great meal waiting for them, that they had a plush bed that the Pullman Porters had made up for them, and most important, that they had safety. And what they would do in return for the Pullman Porters was, in the middle of the night, they would do a jam session just for the Porters.
Wow.
And Susan, I don't know about you, but if I could go back in any moment in history, it wouldn't be a bad moment to have Louis Armstrong and his band playing just for us on that Pullman sleeper.
Absolutely. And it's so terrible that the porters themselves often had trouble finding places to sleep.
They did. And so there was an informal network. Long before there was anything called the Green Book, there was an informal network where traveling entertainers like Louis Armstrong, traveling Pullman porters, and traveling Negro Leaguers like Satchel Paige would informally exchange information, telling people this is a safe place to get a great meal or to have a safe bed. in whatever town they were traveling in.
Is this a book you felt you had to be ready to write, that it came along at the right time in your career?
It did, and yet it was a book that, had I known about earlier, I might have been inspired to at least try to write earlier. Mm-hmm. I was naive, and I thought that if you were writing a book about three separate people, that you'd only have to do a third of the work for each of them. And what I discovered, of course, is that a reader doesn't care whether I'm writing about three people or 10 people. If I'm writing them, they want to presume that I know the full story. So it was three times the work that I had done for any single biography. I ended up with 8,500 pages of notes from interview transcripts and from readings I had done. But it also was the most fun that I think I've ever had doing anything. Can you imagine calling it work, hanging out with Louis Armstrong, Duke Ellington, and Count Basie for a couple of years? Was a pretty nice way to earn a living.
And this was during the pandemic, too, wasn't it?
Well, I started it at the end of the pandemic. I had spent the pandemic writing a book about a guy who was a whole lot less joyful named Senator Joseph McCarthy.
Right.
And my reward to myself and my publisher's reward to me was to be able to do this one after having finished that one.
That's quite a reward. And one of the things you've done that I think is so generous is donate all your research materials to the Armstrong House.
I did, and I did that partly because I think I stood on the shoulders of all the books that had come before, and I felt like people should be able to have my research, but I picked that museum over others that seemed interested because that is one of the most authentic museums I've ever been to. The idea of not being able to just go and look at artifacts or papers from somebody like Louis Armstrong, but to actually get a feel in every room of that house for the way he lived his life in all of his adult years is amazing.
Now, these three musicians all come from different parts of America. Could you describe the influence of place on their work?
The influence of place was enormous on their lives and therefore on their work. And in Louis Armstrong's case, as probably your listeners know, he grew up in a part of New Orleans that was so tough that it was known as the battlefield. And I'm convinced that the reason he survived into adulthood is because at age 13, he was grabbed off the street by a detective of the police department for firing his stepfather's gun into the air on New Year's Eve. And so many of the kids that he hung out with on the streets didn't make it through their teenage years. Armstrong was grabbed off the streets, sent to the Colored Waifs Home, a segregated reform school, and it was there that he became inspired first by the bugle, then by the cornet, and ultimately by his world-famous trumpet. And he did what Booker T. Washington was advising blacks of that era to do, which is to be educated in doing one thing so well that nobody could ever take it away from him. And that's what happened to him in New Orleans.
Now, what about Count Basie in New Jersey?
He grew up in an area that was not segregated by law the way that New Orleans was, but it was by fact. He grew up as the son of a gardener and a laundress. And it was in a place called Red Bank. And if your listeners have never been to Red Bank, I would advise that they don't bother going there. The only thing worth knowing about Red Bank, New Jersey, is that Count Basie grew up there. As soon as he got old enough to realize what he wanted to do and to be able to articulate that, he told everybody he knew he wanted to get the heck out of Red Bank. He initially dreamed of doing that by joining the circus. He ended up deciding that playing the piano was his route to escape. And he played the piano in communities around Red Bank to start with, and then he learned at the feet of the great Fats Waller in New York City.
Right. And Duke Ellington had a very different experience in Washington, D.C.
His was a sort of blend of the other two. It was in an area that, in terms of racial laws, was about in between. It was partly Southern traditions and partly Northern. And he grew up in a very middle-class family in the largest middle-class black community in America. And when he was a kid, when he was getting ready for school, in the morning, he would walk down the steep set of stairs in his home. And he would tell his young nephew, who were standing at the bottom of the stairs, to bow to him. He would tell his young nieces to curtsy. And he would tell adults and children, applaud, because someday the world is going to know me as the great and the grand Duke Ellington. So from a very young age, he had a sense of destiny, he had a sense of royalty, and he lived up to his aristocratic name. He used to have about 10 different versions of where the name Duke, the nickname Duke, came from. But don't believe any of them. The truth is that he dubbed himself Duke, and that was the way it happened.
Such style, all three of them, such style all through their lives.
They did, and they had unique styles. I picked these three in part because they were born within 5 years of one another,
right,
in part because they lasted an inconceivable half century at the top of their profession, and in part, as you suggest, because they came from different enough places and were different enough people that they suggest when you put them together, just about every geographic and personality type that we can imagine in America.
If you're just joining us, I'm talking with Larry Tye. His new book is The Jazzmen, How Duke Ellington, Louis Armstrong, and Count Basie Transformed America. Well, one of the most fascinating parts of this book is your analysis of their signature songs and how they changed. And I wonder if you'd talk a little bit about each of them, because that was so much fun to read.
The signature song of each of them at the beginning said a lot about who they were in their early days. And
yeah,
by the end, they had all changed signature songs, and it talked about their change. And in Louis Armstrong's case, it was a song that was very controversial in the black world.
Mm-hmm.
It was called When It's Sleepy Time Down South. And it seemed to an untuned ear to be romanticizing plantation life and the life of Jim Crow post Reconstruction South. If there was anybody in the world who was not going to romanticize that, it was Louis Armstrong, who had grown up with evidence every day of his second-class status as being black. But what he was doing was talking about the way life really was in the South when he grew up there, and that song captured it. By the end, Louis Armstrong had shown that he could take the worst pop song in the world and make it into something that you wanted to listen and something that seemed like it had both heart and soul. And he showed that by his signature song at the end of his career, which was Hello, Dolly. And Hello, Dolly was a song that at age 63, Louis Armstrong displaced the Beatles from number one in the pop charts with this second-rate song that he gave incredible energy to. In Duke Ellington's case, his theme song at the beginning was the song Take the A-Train, and everybody knew Take the A-Train. It was a song that his brilliant protege, Billy Strayhorn, had written using Duke Ellington's instructions on how to get to his place in Harlem when Billy was coming for an interview, and he turned those instructions, which included Take an A-Train, he took those instructions and made it into a song, and that guaranteed him the job. By the end of his career, Duke Ellington had what I think of, he may not have thought of it as his theme, but it was what to me was his signature song, which was King Fit the Battle of Alabama. And it was about Martin Luther King and about a police chief in Alabama, a notorious police chief named Bull Connor, who turned his police and fire hoses on young black demonstrators in Birmingham. And Duke Ellington had always said he spoke through his music. And the song that he composed for the Birmingham demonstrations was a song that showed how angry he was at what was happening to those young kids. So he was the militant that I think he always really was underneath his aristocratic surface by the end. In the case of Count Basie, his signature song was called 1 o'clock Jump, and it was classic Kansas City swing style that Basie had made famous in America. And it was a song that they used to say that if you listen to that song and your toes weren't tapping by the end, you ought to go see a doctor the next day because something had to be anatomically wrong with you.
Right.
That was what he started out as, and that was his swing that I think what made his band special throughout his entire 50-year career. But by the end, the song that skyrocketed him to fame was called Fly Me to the Moon. And Fly Me to the Moon was a song that the Apollo astronauts actually took up in their flights. And in those days, Walter Cronkite or the other anchors used to interview the astronauts when they were in outer space. And they talked about listening to that music with the Basie band and with Frank Sinatra singing the vocals. And that was a song that took him to the moon in terms of his record sales and his ratings. So they all had veered in their career, but in different directions.
And you write so wonderfully about the difference between being an artist and being an entertainer, and how being an entertainer was leveled as a criticism.
So it was a criticism leveled at all three of them, but especially Louis Armstrong, and that was the least of the criticisms leveled against him. He was called an Uncle Tom, an Aunt Jemima. He was basically disparaged by many young, especially black activists, who thought that this guy who went on stage and went on television with his handkerchiefs and hamming it up, they took that as a sign that he was just playing in a way that was unseemly to white audiences. But they and I were totally wrong. This was a guy who saw no contradiction between being an entertainer, because he understood he was playing to audiences that may or may not be comfortable with him and with his race, but he never demeaned his art. He understood that you could be a brilliant artist, and he certainly was the most brilliant trumpet player, if not the most brilliant all-round jazz musician ever. He was a singer who could sing with the same heart that he played the trumpet, and anybody who didn't get who he was should have seen him in 1957 when the Little Rock High School was being integrated. And a racist governor named Orville Faubus was essentially standing in the doorway saying, "You will integrate Central High School over my dead body." And Louis Armstrong watched what Faubus was doing. He watched the fact that President Eisenhower wasn't sending in troops. And he told the young newspaper reporter, "That governor is," and he used a word that begins with M, that ends with R, and that I won't say over a family radio station, but it ended up being translated into the newspaper into calling the governor an uneducated plowboy. Mm-hmm. He called our war hero president gutless. And he convinced me, and I think he convinced anybody who was listening, that he was the opposite of an Uncle Tom. And I can't prove this, but I'm convinced that Eisenhower eventually sent in troops because this musician that he adored, Louis Armstrong, had called him out and he realized that he was wrong.
Now, all three of these musicians lived lives as global citizens, as ambassadors for the United States, even if at times they were less than pleased with their homeland, and they had great stature in the world.
They had enough stature that the State Department sent them as informal ambassadors all around the world, to Africa, to Latin America, to all the unaligned countries that we were competing with the Soviet Union to have in our camp. They also sent them behind the Iron Curtain, and they realized that America's biggest vulnerability in its competition with the Russians was our supposed racism. And who better to send out than not just distinguished black entertainers and musicians and geniuses like these three, but men who they knew, and they were proven right, that as soon as they left our shores, they understood that criticizing America overseas was a step that nobody should take. And so when asked about racial troubles back home, they would say, "Yes, we have problems, and yes, we are fixing them." They were the ultimate optimists, and they were the perfect ambassadors to send around the world representing America.
Now, all three of these musicians left behind memoirs. They all thought books were important, even if they weren't great readers. I mean,
But very different kinds of memoirs.
Right.
Totally a piece of who they were. Louis Armstrong wasn't satisfied just writing one memoir. He didn't want to trust people like me years later to get him right. So he wrote three different memoirs, and he put himself out there in each of the memoirs, and you had a sense that this was not just authentic, but this was a unique voice. It was a voice that he used his own spelling, his own punctuation, and the authors, the publishers of the memoirs, wisely kept that in because it was so much a piece of who he was. Duke Ellington gave us a really captivating story, but a sanitized one. His book was titled Music is My Mistress, and it was him in this aristocratic sense, and he never let down the shelves. And Count Basie wrote a classic Count Basie autobiography. It was called The Goodnight Blues, and it was there was never anything in the book that let slip his sense that the public doesn't really have a right to know who he was as a person. So he would come right up to the edge of telling an interesting story, and then he would tell you as the reader, I'm not going to tell you that. We don't need to go into that in public. And the only three people on the planet who I'm convinced read cover to cover Count Basie's memoir were Count Basie, his ghostwriter, who was a great jazz writer and must have been the most frustrated guy in the world, and me. And I think that it read like a boring travelogue.
Oh, now, you know, I sort of think of Armstrong as a writer as much as anything because of the volume of things he produced. That classic, you know, My Life in New Orleans has been read by generations. The typewriter, that signature phrase, red beans and ricely yours, the way he'd make collages. I mean, I think of him as a fully rounded writing musician person.
So I think writer is one good word to use to describe what he did. And he wrote perpetually, including articles for magazines and newspapers, as well as the three memoirs. But the word that I would use is storyteller. And he told stories in any way he could. He told them through his trumpet. He told them through his raspy voice. He told them through what he wrote. And he told them through the thousands upon thousands of hours of tape recordings that he did on the road and at home. Sometimes people he was recording understood that he was recording their conversation. Other times he just turned on the recorder, which was hidden in a bookshelf, and nobody knew it. But he could tell stories in more different ways than anybody I know. And he told a story that was good enough to make him... There was a point in the 1950s where a poll was done on who the most recognizable American cultural figures were around the world. And the answer was Mickey Mouse and Louis Armstrong.
Wow. Now, I'm curious, you spent a lot of your time in your writing life immersed in African American history. And to write a book about a person, you have to care about them deeply and identify with them deeply. So I'm curious what lessons you took for yourself from writing these books, this book in particular.
I took a couple lessons. I took the lesson that race remains the story of America, and that to understand where we are and where we're going, we have to understand our racial history. And I'm convinced that nobody would sit down if I had written a history of Jim Crow. But a history of Jim Crow, disguised as a history of three of the most rollicking musicians ever, is a way of helping me, at least, and I hope readers, understand something about the history of race in America and the extraordinary progress we've made, but the really embarrassing racial elements of our past. But I also think it has convinced me that you never can tell a story, a biography of somebody as just being about that single person, or in this case, three people. Mm-hmm. Every biography that is ever worth writing and reading is a story of something deeper. And to me, it's the story of how three people that we think we know because we've heard their music and hopefully we love their music, that their story has a second half to that legacy, and that is the story of how they not just grew up in a Jim Crow world, but how they helped tear down those segregation barriers.
We've been talking with Larry Tye about his new book, The Jazz Men, How Duke Ellington, Louis Armstrong, and Count Basie Transformed America. Larry, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Mine too. Thank you very much.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Jennifer Moorhead discusses and signs her debut novel, Broken Bayou, Saturday, July 13th at 2 at Blue Cypress Books. There will be a poetry reading featuring Dylan Krieger and Benjamin Morris, Monday, July 15th at 6:30 at Blue Cypress Books. Jocelyn Takach discusses and signs Pierce Oysters, a novel, Tuesday, July 16th at 6 at Baldwin & Company. Lawrence Wells presents and signs his two new books, Ghostwriter, Shakespeare, Literary Landmines, and an Eccentric Patron's Royal Obsession, and Fair Youth, a novel, Wednesday, July 17th at 6 at Octavia Books. The Friends of the Jefferson Public Library will hold a box sale of children's books and music CDs Saturday, July 27th from 9 to 4 or until sold out. That's at East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Boxes of books will be sold for $5 each, as well as boxes of CDs. Boxes will be labeled as to what they contain, but cannot be opened prior to purchasing. Also coming up, to celebrate the publication of the 1619 Project in paperback, Baldwin & Company presents Nicole Hannah-Jones in conversation with Daniel Black, Saturday, July 27th at 4 at the George's Auditorium at Dillard University. Tickets available at Eventbrite. Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, with major support from Rouse's Markets. Additional support comes from the Hellis Foundation, the Jefferson Parish Public Library, and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in The Reading Life do not necessarily represent those of the National Endowment for the Humanities. The theme song for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Ingmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at WWNO.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@WWNO.org.